This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and coming up, what does the future hold for refugees on Manus Island now after the PNG Supreme Court rejects their claim for compensation and the right to hold travel documents? An internet transformation for Solomon Islands is a step closer as mapping for an undersea fibre optic cable begins. And another landmark for the Orchids captain, Kathy Neap, as she takes charge of PNG NRL and their highly successful Leap Long Life program.
Being a woman and actually being given this position, which is in the game of mostly dominated by men, so that's what really interests me to take the first step in leading an organization like this.
More from Kathy Neap later in the program. But first, more than 2 years after police opened fire on student protesters at the University of Papua New Guinea, the former Vice-Chancellor of UNITEC, Albert Schramm, has made a damning claim about the motive and the origin of the shooters who were at the heart of the incident. As Nick Fogarty reports, Dr. Schramm was dealing with similar anti-government protests on his campus in Lae at the time, and now he's leading the call for promised inquiries to deliver their findings.
When the smoke finally cleared at the University of Papua New Guinea's Port Moresby campus on the 8th of June 2016, around 20 people had been injured by police gunfire. For weeks, there had been growing unrest in Port Moresby from students who were unhappy with the stalling of corruption allegations against the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill. There had also been rioting and looting in the Highlands and the North Coast, and on this day in the capital, things reached a tipping point. Opposition MP and Oro Province Governor Gary Juffa was on his way to Parliament when he heard on the radio that students had gathered to protest and police were there to confront them.
Gunshots had already been fired, students had already been shot, and students were about to retaliate.
The injured were treated at Port Moresby General Hospital, while those who remained were prevented from carrying out their wish of marching to Parliament to support a no-confidence motion against the Prime Minister. Peter O'Neill later said the police had only fired warning shots and tear gas because students had thrown rocks at them, but now Albert Schramm, who was Vice-Chancellor of UNITEC at the time, says there might be a different explanation.
And that shooting came at a very convenient moment, we must remember, because it was the last day of the parliamentary hearings where the opposition was allowed to send in a motion of no confidence in the government. So somebody in the government circles, and nobody knows who, must have given the orders that anything had to be done to prevent the students from doing their peaceful demonstration at Parliament.
And Albert Schramm claims the police involved in the shooting weren't regulars from Port Moresby.
I have some statements from council members who told me that a special group of policemen with high-powered rifles that usually deal with tribal fights in the Highlands was on the UPNG campus on the 8th of June 2016. Now, that's no coincidence. Somebody must have moved them there. That is just plain logic. Now, who did what and who gave the orders? That is a matter for the investigation to determine. But apparently the stakes are so high that this investigation has never been organised or funded.
In the weeks after the violence, separate inquiries were promised by the government, the police and the Ombudsman Commission, but no reports have materialised. All have been contacted by the ABC seeking official comment, but none has responded so far. While opposition MP Gary Juffa disputes the claim that the shooting was deliberate and politically motivated, he too laments the delay in the investigations, which he puts down to the under-resourcing of police.
I don't think it was deliberate. I think it was just a policeman who lost control and fired a shot. I don't think there was any real ideology or intention behind it. That particular policeman ought to be charged and taken to task or dealt with or disciplined, you know, but nothing has happened. The police are under-resourced. They simply don't have the capacity. And inquiries like these are not going to get the attention they deserve. There should be an effort to progress this inquiry and review or expose the facts about what happened on that day and why the students were shot.
The Shadow Justice and Police Minister, Karenga Kua, says the fact that any inquiry is yet to report is no surprise to him.
The Prime Minister has a habit of promising inquiries which never materialise. Or if an inquiry does take place simply because there's pressure from the public, then over time, as the inquiry runs along, the temperature cools down and the people tend to move on to a new crisis. And then the old investigation or inquiry is forgotten. And when the results are finally released to the Prime Minister, he doesn't table it.
That's PNG's Shadow Justice and Police Minister, Karenga Kua, ending that report from Nick Fogarty. The Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea has rejected a petition by a group of refugees and asylum seekers that would have given them the right to sue for compensation. The 368 men were also seeking the right to apply for PNG travel documents, which would allow them to resettle in other countries. Now, though, as Yara Murray-Atfield reports, the men are watching on, hopefully, as Australian politicians debate the possibility of resettling at least some of the refugees from both Manus and Nauru in New Zealand.
In 2016, the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court found asylum seekers and refugees on Manus Island had been illegally detained, opening the door for possible legal action. The case dismissed by the court was arguing the refugees had been subject to human rights breaches. The lawyer for the plaintiffs, Ben Lomai, says their fight isn't over yet.
But it's a better decision that basically dismissing the entire proceedings for the asylum seekers, which means that effectively that will be the end of the matter. But that is not the case because we are yet to study the judgment.
As the decision was being handed down, politicians in Australia were debating a years-old New Zealand offer to resettle 150 refugees from Manus Island and Nauru. Bruce Bachani is an Iranian journalist and refugee who's been on Manus since 2013 and has become an unofficial spokesman for the refugee and asylum seeker men who live there.
We are following the news closely. Most of the refugees are happy never put foot in Australian soil, and they are happy to go to New Zealand.
Mr. Bachani says he's been watching hopefully as pressure mounts on the Australian government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has alluded to accepting the offer only if the refugees were never allowed into Australia, which the opposition Labor Party has signalled it would support. Catherine Stubberfield is the spokeswoman for the UN's refugee body in Canberra, the UNHCR.
What we've seen in recent weeks is a very significant deterioration in the health situation, and that's not only on Nauru, it is equally on Manus Island and in Papua New Guinea. And it's very important that nobody gets left behind. There's been a lot of attention on children, but adults are vulnerable too.
Humanitarian groups have warned of an impending mental health crisis on Manus, and Mr. Bachani says mental states are deteriorating.
Day by day getting worse, and many people on Manus Island are deeply depressed.
Australia is a signatory to the UN's Refugee Convention and processes the majority of resettlement cases through the UNHCR. A deal with the United States to take the refugees was struck in 2016, but hundreds remain waiting to be processed. Professor Jane McAdam is the director of the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law. She says people are accepted according to criteria set by both the UNHCR and the country accepting them.
Sometimes children and families can be prioritised where it's seen that they are in particularly vulnerable conditions. But there's no general rule that says families and children are necessarily the first to be resettled.
All of the refugees and asylum seekers living on Manus are adult men. But Mr. Bachani says many of them have families in Australia and elsewhere.
Many people on Manus didn't see their families for more than 5 years. So it's not only single men on Manus.
For Mr. Bachani, hope over moves towards a possible resettlement deal is tempered by the fact that New Zealand's offer is only to take a fraction of those in offshore processing.
It's a very complicated issue because 150 people get freedom, but in other side, many people will remain.
The Supreme Court dismissal was due to a technicality. The judge says the case should have been pursued in the country's national court. In Port Moresby, lawyer Ben Lomai says he'll consult with his clients before deciding their next steps, but another case could take years.
Yara Murray-Atfield reporting, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia with me, Richard Hewitt. The coordinator for MOG, the multinational observer group that will monitor next month's general election in Fiji, says preparations are going well and the electoral office's state of readiness is much improved compared to 4 years ago. Alice Court, who's a senior career officer with the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, says she and her team have been taking a close look at the voter registration process, candidate nominations, and now in the countdown to November 14th and polling day, voter awareness programs.
They've had more time to prepare for this election than in 2014, and that's allowed more time for training of electoral workers and voter education, and the MOG has been here and able to observe some of that. We anticipate greater familiarity on the part of the voters and the electoral workers of this system, which is now the second election under the current electoral system. Our terms of reference for the multinational observer group have us assessing how well the Fijian Elections Office has prepared voters and its staff for the election, both through technical operations and how effective its voter education and awareness has been. So we'll make a formal observation about Fiji's preparedness after the election.
Are there particular aspects of what has been happening so far that have caught your attention for good or for reasons of concern?
So we're here to observe a range of electoral processes and talk to a range of institutions and agencies implementing the election, as well as political parties, civil society organisations. And at the end of the day, we'll be assessing whether or not the outcome of this election reflects the will of the Fijian voters and whether or not Fijian voters were able to exercise their right to vote freely. So a number of things will go into that assessment, but we don't intend to make our observations public until the end of the period, but we're looking broadly and widely.
You mentioned civil society there, though, and certainly in the report that came after the election 4 years ago was that civil society participation was, quote, unduly restricted. Now, as you pointed out, you're not going to make a judgment at this stage, but is this something that you're particularly looking out for to see how civil society functions in the election this time?
Yes, so the 2014 MOG looked at a wide range of issues, and we've studied those, and we've also studied the Fijian response and any changes to the Fijian framework and practice and environment since, and we are talking to a wide range of organisations from civil society. But as you say, we'll be reserving our observations until after the election.
And in terms of getting the information out to voters, are you already seeing practical signs of a difference perhaps compared to what happened 4 years ago?
We're following those preparations for this election very closely, and I think that the people of Fiji would expect us to take the time to consider these very complex issues before making any observations.
And what lies ahead then for you between now and polling day? Will you and other members of the group be covering as much of the country as possible?
Absolutely. So we'll continue our consultations with political parties and civil society and those that are actively engaged in the election. We'll continue to observe operational issues. Especially important coming up are the pre-poll and the voting and the counting. And we'll be deploying people across Fiji to see as many people and talk to as many political candidates and organisations to get a wide as possible perspective on these elections.
Alice Court, coordinator for the Multinational Observer Group, monitoring Fiji's national election. Next to Solomon Islands, where seabed mapping for the country's first undersea fibre optic cable has begun. The Coral Sea cable system is expected to deliver faster and more reliable internet services for many in the Solomons and Papua New Guinea via a high-speed fibre optic link from Sydney to Honiara and Port Moresby. And as Evan Wasuka reports from Honiara, the undersea cable will connect several provincial centres to the National Domestic Communications Network for the first time.
Over the coming weeks, the research vessel Northern Endeavour will map the waters between Solomon Islands' capital, Honiara, and the provincial centres of Auki, Noro and Taro. The results will be used to work out the domestic route for the fibre optic cable, estimated to be about 700 kilometres long. It's part of the larger Coral Sea cable system, thought to be worth about $200 million Australian dollars, which Australia entered into in July with Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. By providing two-thirds of the cost of the project, Australia enticed Solomon Islands away from a deal it had planned with Chinese firm Huawei. Prime Minister Rick Ho says although the project was inked with then-Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Australia's new Prime Minister has also committed to the project.
This project has the fervent support at the top of government, namely the Prime Minister, well, the former Prime Minister who I met has stated his support, as well as the current Prime Minister, Honourable Scott Morrison. He, of course, has assured me that he supports the project and is very grateful to see what is now being implemented.
Following the announcement of Australia's funding of the Coral Sea cable system, there were concerns over the access to the landing points, which is where the fibre optic cable would come ashore. The Solomon Islands Submarine Cable Company is responsible for the domestic operations of the cable. Its chief executive officer, Kia Preedy, says they are putting together agreements with landowners, which he expects to be finalised over the next 2 months.
We're in the process of signing getting all the agreements we need with the landowning groups around the four landing points. Most of those are already in previously established titled areas that are straightforward commercial agreements. We aim to get memorandums of understanding together so that we can start building in the next 2 months.
Australian company Vocus has been contracted to project manage the Coral Sea cable system, including Solomon Islands' domestic network. In outlining the next steps of the project, Mr. Preedy says work is running on schedule.
From the survey results, we will get the established track, so we'll know the exact length of the cable, and we'll also know how we need to protect various parts of that cable to give durability to the cable over its life, because of sea bottom conditions, other things. With that information, Alcatel, who work for Vocus, can then manufacture all of that length of cable in the right order, assemble it, and they'll be doing that while we're completing the land construction and having our buildings ready for them. So we'd be expecting to see the installation of the cables and the electronics starting from around about June next year. Okay? And then testing through to launch at the end of the year.
Over the weekend, Australia's High Commissioner to Solomon Islands, Roderick Brazier, toured the research vessel Northern Endeavour with Prime Minister Rick Ho. He says Solomon Islanders will see a massive change to the quality of their internet service as a result of the Coral Sea cable system, which will also lead to economic benefits for the country.
It will deliver faster, more reliable internet for the people of Solomon Islands and provide Solomon Islands with a capacity that is approximately 30,000 times greater than current demand. A more reliable, faster internet with far greater capacity will increase connectivity and support business growth.
The Coral Sea cable system will run for 4,700 kilometres from Sydney before splitting between Honiara and Port Moresby, and it's expected to be in operation by the end of 2019.
Evan Wasuka reporting from Honiara. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The inaugural captain of Papua New Guinea's women's rugby league team has achieved another landmark by becoming the first woman to take charge of the highly successful PNG NRL Sport for Development program. Cathy Nyap is taking over from the former Kumuls captain Mark Mom, who's taken on the broader role of Pacific Program Coordinator for the NRL. She can't wait to get started, and it's not hard to see why the PNG Orchids captain has been chosen for the top job, based on a glowing reference from her predecessor.
Probably one of the most hardworking people I've ever come across. We're really proud of her and very happy for her to take this program and lead the staffing up in PNG over the next few years.
What excites me is like the bigger challenges coming on that I'm going to be facing, and also being a woman and actually being given this position, which is in the game of mostly dominated by men. So that's what really interests me, to take the first step in leading an organization like this.
But with the Orchids on the rise, will Cathy Nyap be able to manage two careers? She says she's ready to answer the call to play for the national team once again, but the day job will take precedence from now on.
I'm still passionate about playing and doing my job at the moment. So it depends on the time that I will have on hand. If I have enough time, then I could play also. But if I don't have enough time, then I'd stick to my career.
Mark Mom says that as Nyap has risen up the ranks with PNG NRL, she's brought more and more women into the organisation and into the game. And now that she's in charge, she expects the level of interest in rugby league from women in PNG to grow even more.
One of her strengths is she started right from the bottom as a game development officer, which I didn't do. She knows our program back to front. So when we're talking about wanting to achieve development outcomes, she can understand how to bring that right down to the ground and operational and activity level right into a classroom.
At the heart of the PNG NRL setup is League Long Life, the program that encourages healthy lifestyles for girls and boys while boosting their physical, social, maths and reading skills.
Child, what did you want to be when you grow up? Everyone, let's read.
Independent research conducted by La Trobe University in Melbourne has found that League Long Life stimulates positive change and promotes gender equality. And Cathy Nyap says that even extends to the reading program now, which captures children's interest by encouraging them to find out about their favourite players.
We do have some Orchids players like Maima Wei, who starred in the 2017 Rugby League Reds, the World Cup ones. And also, Jenisu Upa also played for the Orchids in the friendly match. She's also in one of the Rugby League Reds as well. So we're looking forward to having more in there.
By the Papua New Guinea Orchids, my scorer was Mama Wade.
And while Kathy Nyapp continues to build on the foundations laid by Mark Mom in PNG, he is involved in growing similar development programs in other Pacific Rugby League playing countries like Samoa, Tonga and Fiji, where he says the sport and their own version of League Long Life will take off if the Fijian bid to enter a team in the New South Wales Premiership is successful.
Absolutely. Any advancement in the sport will always benefit the community because you can use the sport as leverage for development. Getting a team into the New South Wales Intra Super Cup, it'll be a great win for rugby league in the Pacific, and you can only see the potential to strengthen many parts of the sport and community development.
Meanwhile, back in PNG, Kathy Nyapp is keen to keep the Orchids driving forward, whether she pulls on that jersey again or not.
I'm willing to support the Orchids in every ways that I can to get them up there. If it means at the school levels, back in the competition level, I try my best to create a pathway where they can be able to perfect their game, their skill to go that far.
Kathy Nyapp, captain of the PNG Orchids Rugby League team and now country manager for PNG NRL. And finally, originally from Kiribati, the small population of Banaban Islanders that remain live on Rambi in Fiji after decades of phosphate mining in the early 1900s eventually made their island home uninhabitable. Since their relocation almost 70 years ago, rebuilding their lives in a new country and finding new sources of income have proved difficult for the Banaban's descendants. But as Bindi Bryce reports, the road back to financial independence may lie in a coconut oil business that's helping to stamp out poverty on Rambi.
Banaba Islanders call themselves the Forgotten People of the Pacific. Modern descendants say their people were tricked into signing a controversial deal in 1901 with Pacific Phosphate, a company owned by the British, Australian and New Zealand governments. For the next few decades, the Banaban people received £50 a year, or roughly $4,000 Australian dollars in today's money, while their island was mined for phosphate. Banaban descendant Terikano Takasau says while the deal made them the wealthiest islanders in the Pacific at the time, it wasn't to last.
I used to get royalty bonuses from the phosphate money, and then after royalty stopped, our people, they became poor.
By the end of World War II, Banaba Island was unlivable, and the Australian government shipped the remaining islanders to Rambi Island off Vanua Levu in Fiji, and have been there ever since. For Banaba Islanders, rebuilding their lives in a new country has its challenges, and Terry Takasau says making money on Rambi is not easy.
Especially our women are not those kind of people who are out on the street to sell food, and our men are not used to planting subsistence crops. And I feel sorry for them because they've been living in a better life, and that's how I feel passionate about them, and I wanted to help them.
With the help of the Rambi Local Council, Miss Takasau set up a business called Banaban Virgin Coconut Oil, which exports locally produced coconut oil to overseas markets. Executive Council Leader David Christopher says when it comes to coconuts, there are plenty of income opportunities to go around.
There's abundance of coconut trees on Rambi that are left over from the old plantations, the people who owned the island before us. And then we had a lot of replanting that we've done also. So there's plenty of coconut. That's why we're going into it. It is helping a lot together with fishing. That's enough to sustain the families.
Banaban locals are making money by selling bags of coconuts to the factory. And Terry Takasau says the funds are supporting families across Rambi Island.
The main objective was to help make a difference in the lives of our Banaban women residing at Rambi after the relocation to Fiji, in order to help raise their standard of living so that they would be able to support their children to school, provide their family needs, and also to help alleviate poverty.
The remote Rambi Island has no hotels or resorts and does not receive many tourists, so the Executive Council is looking to export more agriculture such as kava and taro in addition to coconuts to boost the local economy. But Council Leader David Christopher says for the time being, the community still relies on financial support from elsewhere.
Foreign aid will be most always welcome, particularly Australia and New Zealand. After all the damage that has been done in the past, whatever aid that they can provide, that will be most welcome. Financial independence will take some time, but I think we'll get there. Particularly with the help of Fijian government at the moment, we're making ends meet, put it that way.
It may still be hard times ahead, but perhaps a more sustainable future is finally in store for Banaba Islanders.
Bindi Bryce reporting there, and that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. You can always listen to the show on demand by downloading our podcast. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.